Within the next few minutes, you will be exposed to the most forbidden, psychologically brutal, and ultimately liberating knowledge ever extracted from the depths of human suffering. This is not a history lesson. This is a dissection of the female soul, conducted not in a sterile laboratory, but in the frozen hell of the Soviet Gulag, where the extremes of starvation, betrayal, and isolation acted as a cruel acid, stripping away all social pretense to reveal the raw, unvarnished nature of loyalty and betrayal. The men who survived this machine of death carried back with them a secret, a terrifyingly consistent pattern of female behavior that contradicts every fairy tale we've been sold. This is the Solzhenitsyn secret, and understanding it is nothing less than an intellectual and emotional armor against the silent, soft gulag of modern relationships. For centuries, philosophers have debated the nature of women, love, and loyalty from the comfort of oak-paneled studies and sun-drenched Athenian agoras. They produced elegant theories, beautiful in their abstraction, but ultimately useless in the face of real, raw, life-and-death crisis. Their laboratory was the mind. Our laboratory, the one we are about to enter, was built by the NKVD. Its test subjects were millions of men, condemned for a word, a look, a joke, torn from their families and thrown into a meat grinder of ice, hunger, and despair. And the primary variable in this horrific experiment? The women they left behind. Their wives, their lovers, their mothers. The keepers of their memory, the anchors to their past lives. What these men discovered, through a pain so profound it can barely be articulated, was a dark taxonomy of the female psyche under pressure. They mapped the exact contours of conditional love and uncovered the shocking biological imperatives that can override a lifetime of affection in a single moment. This knowledge was paid for in blood, frostbite, and broken souls. It is the ultimate red pill, forged not in internet forums, but in the permafrost of Kalima. Alexander Solzhenitsyn, the great chronicler of this agony, did more than just document the brutality of the state. In his monumental works, particularly The Gulag Archipelago and One Day in the Life of Ivan Denisovich, he provided a meticulous, unflinching record of this grand, unintended sociological experiment. He recorded the letters that never came, the divorce papers that did, the stories whispered on frozen bunks long after the lights were out. He gave us the data. Our task is to decipher it, to move past the shock and horror and extract the timeless, brutal principles. This is not about misogyny. This is about pattern recognition on a grand historical scale. It is about understanding the mechanics of the human heart so you are never blindsided by them. The benefit of this knowledge is a cold, clear-eyed freedom. It is the ability to see the world as it is, not as you wish it to be. It is the end of naive betrayal and the beginning of true sovereign strength. Let us transport ourselves to a specific moment, a case study etched in the frozen memory of the archipelago. Picture a man we'll call Yevgeny, a brilliant young engineer from Leningrad. His crime was being too talented, too promising, a potential rival to a petty party official. One night, the knock on the door, the arrest. His world shrinks to the size of a Black Maria van. His one comfort, his one tether to humanity, is the image of his wife, Anya. Her smile, the way she'd wave from their apartment window. He is processed, sentenced to 10 years of corrective labor for espionage, a charge so absurd it's laughable, yet utterly lethal. He is shipped for weeks in a stifling, feces-strewn railroad car to a camp in Vorkuta, north of the Arctic Circle. His existence becomes a calculation of calories, 500 grams of bread for fulfilling the norm of chopping wood or mining coal, 300 grams if he fails. Men die from a splinter, from a cough, from simply lying down in the snow and deciding not to get up. For the first year, Yevgeny survives on two things, bread and hope. Hope embodied by Anya. He writes letters, whenever he is permitted, on precious scraps of paper. He pours his soul into them. He speaks of their past, their future, his undying love. He reassures her he is innocent, he is strong, he will return. He waits desperately for a reply, for a sign that he still exists in the world outside the wire. Months pass, nothing. His mind, weakened by hunger, begins to concoct horrors. Perhaps she is dead. Perhaps she is in prison herself. This anxiety is a poison more potent than the cold. Then, after 14 months, a letter arrives. It is not the thick, heartfelt packet he dreamed of. It is thin, official. With a trembling, frostbitten hand, he tears it open. It is not from Anya. It is from the local Soviet court in Leningrad. It is a notice of divorce, initiated by her, on the grounds of his conviction and exile. Attached is a short handwritten note. Yevgeny, forgive me. This is too difficult. I must think of my life now. Do not try to contact me again. I have remarried. By Anya.
The shock is not emotional. It is physical. It is a boot to the chest. The air leaves his lungs. The world, already gray, goes completely black and white. The last pillar of his resistance crumbles into dust. That night, he does not eat his bread ration. He gives it away. He stares at the ceiling of the barracks, and the will to fight, the will to endure the unendurable, simply evaporates. He has been killed, not by a guard's bullet, but by a few lines of ink on a page. His body will linger for a few more months, a hollowed-out shell, until a minor case of pneumonia, which stronger men fight off, quietly carries him away. This story is not unique. Solzhenitsyn documents thousands of Yevgenys. He writes, "The wife of a prisoner had to choose immediately, either to renounce her husband or to resign herself to ruin. And how many were capable of such heroism? 1 in 100? 1 in 1,000? This is the first law of the Solzhenitsyn secret. The probability of abandonment is inversely proportional to the social and material cost of loyalty. Love is not an infinite resource. It is a currency. And when the exchange rate plummets, most portfolios are liquidated. Why? Is it simple cruelty? Weakness? Solzhenitsyn and the sociologists who have studied this phenomenon point to something deeper, something biological and evolutionary. Women are the conduits of life. Their primary evolutionary imperative is survival and provision for offspring. They are hypergamist by nature, hardwired to seek the best available provider and protector. A man's value is intrinsically tied to his social status, his resources, his ability to project strength and security. In the blink of an eye, the state stripped Yevgeny of all these things. He was no longer a brilliant engineer, a provider, a protector. He was a Zeke, a convict, a non-person, a social pariah, a genetic dead end. To be associated with him was to invite ruin upon herself and any potential children. Her love, however genuine it once was conditional upon his status. When that status was annihilated, the love, for the vast majority, could not survive. The abandonment was not necessarily malicious. It was often a brutal, pragmatic act of evolutionary self-preservation. She wasn't betraying him. She was saving herself. Understanding this cold biological calculus is the first step towards removing the emotional sting of betrayal. You are not being betrayed for who you are. You are being discarded for what you have or have not become in the marketplace of survival. But the story does not end with the Yevgenys, for there was another, far rarer breed of woman, the exception that proves the rule. Solzhenitsyn called them the Zek wives, or the Decembrists' wives, hearkening back to the noble women who followed their exiled husbands to Siberia after the failed revolt of 1825. These were women who defied the probability. They not only stayed loyal, they actively fought. They renounced their comfortable lives, their careers, their social standing. They moved to filthy, remote towns near the camps just to be closer. They spent years standing in endless lines to deliver meager food packages, a few potatoes, a lump of sugar, a piece of sausage, that often meant the difference between life and death for their men. They became experts in bureaucracy, tirelessly writing appeals, pestering officials, refusing to be silenced. Their loyalty was not passive, it was a furious, active campaign of resistance. Consider the story of Natalia Rysatovskaya, Solzhenitsyn's own first wife. Their relationship was a tumultuous roller coaster that itself became a microcosm of these very themes. After his arrest in 1945, she did not initially divorce him. She was a university student with her whole life ahead of her. The pressure was immense. Yet she corresponded with him, sent what she could. However, as years dragged on with no end in sight, the pressure cracked her resolve. In 1949, succumbing to the relentless demands of the state and society, she did divorce him. It was a devastating blow to Solzhenitsyn in the camps. Yet in a stunning reversal of the usual narrative, when he was released into internal exile in 1953, she sought him out again and they remarried in 1957. Her loyalty, though it faltered, was not completely extinguished. Their eventual final divorce, later in life, was born of a different kind of conflict. The conflict between the man who returned from the abyss forever changed, a hardened prophet, and the woman who wanted a normal life with the young husband she remembered. But her story shows the complex, messy, and sometimes contradictory application of these principles. Even the exceptions are fraught with struggle. What separated a Natalia from an Anya? What alchemy of character created a Decembrist wife? Solzhenitsyn suggests it was a combination of immense personal strength, a deep, almost spiritual conception of love that transcended material circumstance, and often a certain ideological fervor or independent of mind that made them immune to social pressure. They saw their man not for what society said he was, a criminal, an enemy, but for who he truly was. Their hypergamy was not for social status, but for a deeper, unshakable character they perceived in him, a quality that even the gulag could not erase. This is the second law of the Solzhenitsyn secret. Unconditional loyalty is a historical anomaly, ascribed to a minute fraction of women possessing pre-selected virtues of extreme independence and ideological fortitude. You cannot expect it. You can only recognize it, and with immense gratitude, cherish it if you are ever fortunate enough to find it. To bet your emotional survival on finding such a woman is to bet against the house, in a game where the odds are catastrophically, historically stacked against you. This is not ancient history. The gulag is just the most extreme, concentrated lens through which to view a truth that operates every day, in every city, in every relationship around you. The mechanisms are just softer, slower, more insidious. A man loses his job. A man falls into depression. A man suffers an illness that saps his strength and vitality. A man simply fails to maintain frame, to lead, to project a vision of strength and security. The slow withdrawal of affection, the loss of respect, the condescending looks, the "I love you but I'm not in love with you" speech. These are the modern, civilized equivalents of the divorce paper from Anya. They are the same biological imperative playing out in slow motion, without the dramatic backdrop of Siberian snow. The prison wire has been replaced by the subtle constraints of social expectation and financial entanglement, but the prison is real. The betrayal, when it comes, feels just as final, just as absolute. The Solzhenitsyn secret gives you the framework to see it coming. It allows you to diagnose the conditions of your own relationship, not with hope and prayer, but with the cold, analytical eye of a historian studying a recurring pattern. It removes the surprise, and in doing so, removes much of the pain. The pain is replaced by power, the power of foresight. This knowledge is your first layer of armor, but it is only the beginning. For the men in the camps who received these letters, their reaction determined whether they lived or died. Yevgeny gave away his bread and died. But what did the survivors do? The ones who absorbed this ultimate black pill, this most bitter of truths, and used it not as a poison to kill themselves, but as a fuel to forge themselves into something unimaginably hard, something that could outlast the state itself. How did they reframe this ultimate betrayal into the cornerstone of a new, unassailable masculinity? The answer to that question, and the final, crucial step in mastering the Solzhenitsyn secret, lies in the forging. We will uncover the survivors' mindset, how they transferred their hope from the unreliable hearts of women to the unshakable fortress of their own mission. We will expose the psychological transformation that turned victims into phoenixes and how you can apply the same ancient, icy wisdom to build a life of purpose so powerful that betrayal becomes nothing more than an irrelevant whisper on the wind.
The man who opened the thin official envelope and read his own obituary, not in the newspaper, but in his wife's handwriting, stood at the most critical juncture of his life. The shock was a seismic event that shattered the foundation of his world. In the frozen silence of the barracks, surrounded by the ghosts of men already broken, he faced a choice that was, in its essence, the entire sum of human philosophy reduced to a single brutal decision. He could follow Yevgeny's path. He could let the cold that entered his heart spread to his limbs, surrender to the void and allow his body to complete what the betrayal had started. Or he could do something else. Something far more difficult, far more unnatural, and ultimately far more powerful. He could accept the unacceptable. He could swallow the black pill whole, not as a poison, but as a bitter, strengthening tonic. He could look into the abyss of this ultimate truth that his existence, his value, his very right to love was now conditional upon things outside of his control, and instead of weeping, he could nod. He could say to himself, "So, this is how the world is. Now I know." This moment of acceptance was not a moment of defeat. It was the first crucial step in the forging. The survivors of the Gulag, the men who walked out of the wire years later, their bodies scarred but their spirits terrifyingly intact, had all undergone this forging. They discovered a terrifying and liberating inversion, the very thing designed to annihilate them, the total withdrawal of external validation, of love, of status, could become the source of their ultimate strength. When every pillar of the world they knew was kicked out from under them, they were forced to find a foundation within themselves. Solzhenitsyn called this process ascending. He wrote of those who, stripped of everything, began to care less for their body and more for their soul. "It was only when I lay there on rotting prison straw that I sensed within myself the first stirrings of good. Bless you, prison, for having been in my life." This is not the masochistic gratitude of a broken man. It is the roaring triumph of a man who has discovered the fundamental truth of masculine power, that your value cannot be given to you, and therefore it cannot be taken from you. It must be forged in the private fires of your own suffering and hammered into existence on the anvil of your unbreakable will. The betrayal of a woman, no matter how intimate, was revealed for what it truly was. Not a verdict on his soul, but a reflection of her nature and a withdrawal of a resource he never should have relied upon in the first place. This transformation required a complete and total transference of hope. Hope is a dangerous thing. In the outside world, hope was placed in a letter, in a woman, in a system of justice, in a future reunion. This external hope was a fragile thread that, when cut, caused a man to bleed out emotionally. The survivors learned to kill that kind of hope. They performed a psychological surgery on themselves, cutting out the cancerous need for external salvation. In its place, they cultivated a different, far more resilient kind of hope, an internal, glacial hope based solely on their own agency. Their hope was not that they would be saved, but that they could endure the next minute, the next hour, the next swing of the hammer. Their world shrank from a vast, terrifying sentence of 10 years to a manageable, immediate challenge of the next 5 minutes. This hyper-focus on the present moment, on the absolute dominion over one's own immediate sphere, is a power available to any man anywhere. The man stressing over his wife's quiet disrespect at dinner is bleeding out from a cut thread of external validation. The survivor's mindset asks, can you control her disrespect? No. Can you control your reaction to it? Absolutely. Can you control your next action, your next word, your next breath? Without a doubt. This is the territory of the sovereign man. His hope is not that the world will be kind to him, but that he will be strong enough for the world. Consider the story of Dmitry, a historian arrested for ideological deviation. He received the letter from his fiancée, a woman he had loved since university, telling him that she had married a high-ranking officer in the very NKVD that had arrested him. The betrayal was a masterpiece of cruelty. For 2 days, Dmitry was catatonic. On the third day, during the grueling march to the worksite, something snapped into place. He told himself a story, a reframe of such colossal proportions that changed his reality. He thought, "She has not betrayed me. She has simply revealed herself to me. The state, by arresting me, did not take my life. It gave me a gift. It showed me the truth of the woman I loved before I built a life with her, before I had children with her. They have done me a service." This was not copium. This was alchemy. He was turning the lead of betrayal into the gold of clarity. From that day forward, Dmitry saw his imprisonment not as a punishment, but as a gruesome university. His subject was human nature. His professors were the guards, the informers, and the betrayed men around him. His fiancée was not a villain in his story. She was a crucial lesson plan. This ability to reframe catastrophe as education is the hallmark of the unbreakable mind. The modern man who is betrayed, cheated on, or divorced must perform this same alchemy. The question is not, why did she do this to me, but what is this teaching me about the world and about myself? This internal fortress was built brick by brick with rituals of unbreakable discipline. In a world designed to reduce men to animals, the survivors clung to rituals of humanity that had no practical purpose other than to assert their own sovereignty. Solzhenitsyn wrote of men who, after a 12-hour day of crushing labor in minus 40-degree weather, would meticulously pick the lice from their shirts, not because it would make a difference, the lice would be back in hours, but because it was an act of order imposed upon chaos. They would recite poetry they had memorized, solve complex mathematical problems in their heads, or teach each other languages. This was not a hobby. This was resistance. Every stanza of Pushkin, recited on a frozen bunk, was a bullet fired back at the state. It was a declaration, "You own my body, but my mind is my own." This practice of deliberate, seemingly pointless discipline is the training ground for sovereignty. The modern man must find his equivalent. The daily workout when you are tired. The reading of a difficult book when you could be scrolling. The act of making your bed with precision. These are your lice-picking rituals. They are tiny, daily declarations that you are the master of your own self. They build the muscle of self-respect so that when external respect is withdrawn, your foundation does not crumble. The most profound transformation, however, was the shift in purpose. The man who entered the camp had a purpose tied to his old life: to be a good husband, a good provider, to return to his family. This purpose was extinguished by the letter from Anya. The survivor found a new purpose, one that was completely immune to external forces. His purpose became the preservation of his own integrity, the protection of his inner self. For some, it became a mission of documentation. They became living archives, memorizing names, dates, crimes, determined to one day bear witness. Solzhenitsyn himself began composing and memorizing what would become the Gulag Archipelago while still a prisoner, using a system of matchsticks to help him remember thousands of lines of text. His purpose was no longer to reunite with an old life. It was to expose a truth to the world. This mission was so vast, so important, that it made his personal suffering seem small. His hunger, his cold, his betrayal, these were merely data points in a grand, terrible narrative he was tasked with telling. This is the ultimate reframe. Your pain is not about you. It is fuel for your mission. This is the application for you, the modern man. Your mission cannot be a woman. It cannot be a relationship. These are things that can be taken from you. Your mission must be something so fundamentally yours that its success or failure is dependent on no one but you. Building a business, mastering a craft, creating a work of art, achieving a physical transformation, protecting and providing for your children. Note, this is different from a relationship with a wife. A child's need is unconditional, a wife's is not. When your mission is locked into something this immutable, the withdrawal of a woman's affection becomes a distraction, a minor irritation, like a fly buzzing at the window of a cathedral you are building. It does not stop the construction. She can choose to be a part of your mission or not. Her loyalty is a welcome reinforcement, but her betrayal is not a critical structural failure. You are the architect. The mission is the blueprint. You are the primary labor. She is a subcontractor whose services you may retain or release based on her performance and alignment with the project's goals. This sounds cold. It is. It is the cold of the Arctic. It is also the only way to build something that lasts. The men who emerged from the camps were often unrecognizable to those who had known them before. They were quieter. Their eyes held a depth that made people uncomfortable. They had seen the absolute worst of the world, and in doing so, had lost all fear of it. They understood the price of everything, especially love. They were not incapable of love. In fact, many found a deeper, more profound capacity for connection precisely because they had no illusions about it. Their love was no longer a needy, grasping thing. It was a conscious, deliberate gift, offered from a place of absolute abundance, with no expectation of return. Because they needed nothing from the other person, their love became truly free. This is the final, paradoxical gift of the Solzhenitsyn secret. By accepting the darkest truth of conditional loyalty, you free yourself to experience connection without the chains of need. You can appreciate a woman's love for what it is, a beautiful, fleeting, conditional gift, without demanding it be something it is not. You can cherish the loyalty of a Decembrist wife if you find one, but you will not be destroyed by the betrayal of an Anya. Your life outside the wire is a different kind of test. The threats are not rifles and starvation, but comfort and quiet desperation. The betrayal does not come in an official envelope. It comes in a text message, in a lack of interest, in a lawyer's letter. The principles of survival are identical. Build your internal fortress, Transfer your hope from her validation to your own mission. Impose discipline through daily ritual. Reframe pain as education. Your value is not determined by her eyes. It is forged in your own actions every single day. The Gulag survivors looked into the heart of darkness and found a light that could not be extinguished. You must do the same in the comfortable darkness of the modern world. The wire is not made of steel. It is made of expectations, of fairy tales, of the need to be loved by others more than you love your own purpose. Cut it. Walk through. Your mission awaits.